A reading from the Gospel according to Luke. Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and asked him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless. Then the second and the third married her. And so in the same way, all seven died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had married her. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush, where he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now he is God, not of the dead, but of the living. For to him, all of them are alive. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
In your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. At first glance, the story we hear from the gospel this morning is not exactly what I would call a hit. It's kind of a boring legalistic story about a bunch of rabbis arguing over first century marriage laws. It doesn't seem that it has much to say to you today in 2019. There aren't a lot of people banging down my door asking what Jesus thinks about levirate marriage. Have you heard that vocab word before, levirate marriage? That is the practice of a widow being legally bound to marry her brother-in-law. It's pretty much a thing of the past. But Jesus' response here in this story is actually, I think, one of the top Jesus moments. It illustrates one of the great facets of Jesus' character. Because it is a moment where Jesus cuts through all the circuitous, legalistic questioning his opponents are peppering at him and refocuses them on the point of the gospel. God is a God of the living. God is for the living. You can't get caught up 1,000 steps ahead or worry what's going to happen. You have only to take care of the living and let God take care of the rest. The Sadducees here in the story are trying to bait Jesus with their questions, and Jesus just shuts them up. Stop asking pointless questions. Love the living. There is something especially wonderful, I think, about this story being about marriage. What a funny institution marriage is. And the church has a complicated relationship with it. It always has. At the time of this story, marriage was an institution about property and ownership, specifically of women and their bodies. There's really no way around it. That is what was happening then with marriage. And I think that those roots of marriage still play out in the institution as it stands today. You can see in the Sadducees' questioning of Jesus that they are very unconcerned with that aspect of the question, the well-being of the woman. They only want to trip up Jesus with their trick about heaven. The Sadducees were a group of Jews at the time of Jesus who did not believe in the resurrection. They know that Jesus and his followers do believe, along with many Jews at the time, including the Pharisees. But the Sadducees think they have a question that will get Jesus once and for all and settle this resurrection question. And they come up with this seven-brother scenario. How could someone like Jesus believe in resurrection and this Jewish law about marriage? What will happen in the afterlife when a woman is faced with all of those husbands? The marriage laws of the time pose a problem, therefore, for belief in resurrection. Or that's what the Sadducees would have you believe. Marriage is something that has given me a lot of anxiety in my life. I will go so far as to say, I do not know a woman for whom marriage has not been a source of anxiety. Even if one has been lucky enough to be in a long, healthy marriage, there was probably some moment of anxiety about marriage at some point in her life. Even if a woman is happily unmarried, there is usually someone in her life who is anxious on her behalf. Oftentimes, her mother. I have found that the inherited trauma of the way marriage historically was and the laws around it play out today in this anxiety women have around marriage. Girls are bombarded with wedding culture from the very beginning of their lives. Storybooks and Disney movies are about princesses being rescued by princes. Dress up and costumes are replete with wedding dresses and veils. As a little girl, my absolute favorite movies were Cinderella and The Sound of Music. And I think those are great movies. I still love them. But both of them end with the main character in a huge white gown of ruffles and barrettes and bows and trains. I was so drawn to the beauty and drama of a wedding. Compounding this attraction to weddings, I grew up in a house on the property of a church. And this church had a lot of weddings. And my father was the facilities manager, and so basically every Saturday there were one or two weddings to clean up from. And I would happily go around with him on his Saturday afternoon rounds, trying to catch glimpses of the brides, so many different dresses to take in. I would often go around the church rescuing pew bouquets, the sort of bouquets of flowers that hang off the side of the pews. And then I would enlist my family to act out weddings in our house. I have two brothers, which was very handy, because I would force them to play the husband and the priest. Much to my mother's dismay, who is a priest, I would not let her play the priest, because priests are supposed to be boys. She would have to play a bridesmaid. In a way, these wedding plays were more like gender pageants, a curious habit for 4 to 6-year-old Julia to have taken on. For me, the anxiety about marriage began in adolescence. When I realized, started thinking it through, I did not actually want to be married to a man. Sorry, men. I wanted a wedding. I wanted all the benefits of marriage that are promised to smart young women. And I had the image of what all those genders and roles should look like in my head, including the priest. But I did not actually want what would come after that wedding day. This revelation in adolescence felt like failure. Failure is something adolescent Julia did not enjoy feeling. So I avoided dealing with it for a long time. For other women, the anxiety around marriage can come in many different forms. It can come around divorce or abuse, infertility, wealth or poverty. It can come from the privileges one loses by forging through life as an unmarried woman. Or it can come just from the fatigue of constantly feeling valued only for one's appeal in the eyes of men. This is what is so liberating about Jesus' message in today's gospel. In heaven, there is no giving women away. There is no ownership of women at all. There is no marriage in heaven. In the Gospels, the religious elite are always using the powerless and the marginalized to try to score points against Jesus. Have you noticed this in the Gospels? A mob of self-righteous men drag a terrified woman who is caught in adultery to Jesus and dare him to let her off the hook because she violated Old Testament law. In another part, elite dinner guests berate a broken-hearted woman who anoints Jesus' feet with her tears. The Pharisees criticize Jesus for eating with tax collectors and sinners. And here in this story, the Sadducees concoct this story about a vulnerable widow who is passed from one man to another, like human chattel, just so that they can trip up Jesus. Did you notice that? It's not even a real story about a real person. It is just a hypothetical. In each of these examples in the Gospels, the person in pain is expendable. In each example, human suffering is abstracted for the sake of argument, debate, theological one-upping. No wonder, again and again, it is the marginalized who flock to Jesus, while the privileged find him intolerable. You start to think that maybe the resurrection that Jesus promises is not interesting to the Sadducees because perhaps they're not the ones who really need it. Maybe you have to have experienced some of this anxiety or injustice to fully appreciate the liberation that resurrection actually promises. Imagine what it would feel like for the woman trapped in the Sadducees' story. Imagine her arriving finally, to a place where her worth and her belovedness do not depend on her husband, or her fertility, or her sex appeal. Imagine her basking in the safe, unconditional, eternal love of the God who created her. This is the picture that Jesus paints. If our questions and objections about faith require us to make invalid the lived experiences of real people who are suffering now in this world, then I think we are asking the wrong questions, favoring the wrong objections. When I did get married to my wife, Caitlin, it was because of the faithful and liberating work of so many people before us, who did not allow themselves to be tripped up by the questions and concerns from the people who were like the Sadducees, mostly Christian people. It was because of the work of the people who were focused on resurrection and not on oppression. We got married across town at St. Luke in the Fields in October 2017. And by that point, it was a fact so mundane, it almost boggles the mind to realize it would have been illegal only a few years prior. I have empathy for the Sadducees here in this story. I really do, because they are only trying to defend their beliefs. But they are missing what is right in front of them. They're missing what is right in front of them. What is the thing in your life that is standing in the way of your freedom? What are you clinging to that is preventing your ability to experience resurrection, to live in hope of resurrection? What are you fearful about? What are you anxious about? What are you thinking out 1,000 steps in advance instead of one moment at a time in the land of the living? There is one really big recent life decision that sticks out to me as the example of exactly this kind of thing, which is my decision with Caitlin to have a child. And Harry was born exactly 5 weeks ago today, and we are so grateful to all of the support from everyone here at Grace Church. And actually, he's here, so you should meet him today. There he is. Okay. So he's 5 weeks old, and this is the kind of new life, the kind of result that we never could have imagined over a year ago when we began to plan for it. Anyone who has had a child certainly knows the face of this kind of miracle. There were so many different ways that we could have gone about it, so many different possible routes to take for us to make a family, and I think this is true of every kind of family. We quickly realized that, as with so many big life decisions we make as adults, as soon as you start talking about them, everyone has an opinion. And we heard a lot of opinions. Here's just, a sampling of the kind of opinions we would get, either solicited or perhaps unsolicited. You absolutely have to adopt. It is the only ethical choice. You absolutely have to foster. It is the most needed thing to do. Do not adopt. The system is corrupt. The foster system is a nightmare. You have to adopt. Definitely use an unknown donor. It is the only safe legal route. Never use an unknown donor. Did you read that article in the New York Times Magazine? You should do IVF, you should fertilize Caitlin's egg, then Julia should carry it. It is the closest thing to normal that you can do. Whatever you do, do not do IVF. You should keep it just the two of you. Is there any way that you could just reproduce? We truly heard all of these opinions over the past few years from friends and family and even from strangers. One night we were at a restaurant talking and someone leaned over from the next table to tell us his opinion. He did not agree with what we were discussing, by the way. We realized that it was really only up to us to figure out what route we were going to try to take. After months of talking it out, we realized a few things. Nothing was going to be perfect. I'm sure this is true of every family, right? Nothing is perfect. Perhaps perfection does not exist in family planning, whether you are straight or gay or whatever. We also knew deeply that we would love our child no matter how he or she came into the world. And there might be some things, we realized, that could be even better about making a family the way we wanted to do it. Eventually, after long conversations, we asked our best friend to be our donor. And the silver lining was that his parents could be our child's grandparents. What child is lucky enough to have 6 living and devoted grandparents? For us, this was a choice we made despite the opinions of other people thinking 1,000 steps ahead who thought this might not be the neatest or most logical choice. For us, this was a decision for the living. God is not a God of the dead. This is the line Jesus uses to conclude his response to the Sadducees. Now he is God, not of the dead, but of the living. For to God, all of them are alive. God is always in the business of making new family, new customs, new traditions, new institutions, new people. God is always making things more alive, more vibrant. God challenges you to release what is dead, what is passing away. What new and living thing does God want you to do? What have you been too afraid to let God do through you? So a challenge to you today, dare to live as Jesus desires for you, not with an eye toward death, dead set on what might go wrong, but with a heart for the living, caring for those around you who so desperately need it, with faith in the love that will carry you through. Amen.